This podcast doesn't do commercials for a number of reasons that you'll hear me discuss if you listen long enough. But if you want to support this work, feel free to click on the link at the bottom of most podcatchers that says support the show. Half of everything donated goes to addicted people, people struggling with homelessness, and people who are struggling to get out of prison and back on their feet. Enjoy the show.
The PSA about harm reduction, especially in terms of kind of the carceral environment and drug culture, is more of, if this is already going to occur, how can we make it a benefit rather than a handicap?
Hello, welcome. I'm Ben Boyce, and this is the Dr. Junkie Show. And today I have a conversation with activist, author, and academic C. Dreams. C has a ton of work published in Filter Magazine. Her profile is linked in the episode description, along with her Twitter handle and a GoFundMe she's promoting. If you want to reach out or show your support, start there. I stumbled onto C's work about drugs in prison, which is where we'll spend a lot of our time in this conversation. But we also talk about prison politics, harm reduction, education in prison, the design of the prison industrial complex, the history of incarceration, LGBTQIA rights in prison, tattoos and safe sex in prison, the foster care to prison pipeline, and the general trickiness of doing activism in an environment where people are often punished or targeted for suggesting solutions to problems. Apologies for the rough audio at times. We'll explain all of that some other time in the future. Check out C Dream's work and enjoy the conversation. This is a good one, y'all. I was thinking the best place to start, you've got all of these articles on Filter that are a great place for anybody that wants to know more, to go learn more about some of your history and why you write about what you write about. But I want to focus clearly on drugs in prison, but I think it'd be valuable and helpful to start with a few other things you've written about. And one is education in prison. So can you just introduce yourself and let us know who you are, where you are, what you write about, and why you write about it?
Hi, sure, yeah. So first of all, let me say thank you very much, Ben. I'm super grateful to be on the show with you and definitely been looking forward to it. So for your listeners, my name is C. Dreams, and I am a theologian who studies crime, punishment, and rehabilitation. But I'm also a writer journalist who primarily focuses on criminalization, incarceration, prison conditions, and I guess rehabilitative justice or restorative justice. And I kind of dabble on the side a little bit as a prison policy consultant and a paralegal for a few organizations. And I primarily try to amplify what I call anti-rhetoric around incarceration and the criminal justice system. And I try to challenge the structures that we've put in place and show how they're failing while kind of imposing transparency on the policy makers and decision makers at the state and federal governmental levels.
Sounds personal.
It is personal. It's a vendetta.
Yeah. But you do have like a personal connection in the past where you've been involved in the criminal justice system. Is that right?
I do. So, number one, I grew up as a, you know, we always talk about the kind of a foster care or group home to prison pipeline. Well, I'm a statistic of that. I grew up in as a ward of the state of Maryland and was in foster care. And at 19 years old, I was convicted and charged with sex-related offenses for pimping of a minor and pandering of a minor. My victim was 17 years old, and nobody cared about my past as a child sex worker. They didn't care about my victim, you know, my victimization as a child. All they cared about was this narrative that continues kind of the overreach of policing and incarceration. And so from a very young age, I contended with the prison system as a trans woman. I'm a trans woman of multiracial background. I'm Black and Latina and Irish. And so the things that I went through, the things that I saw, the injustices, just like the sheer travesties of humanity that I saw and that I witnessed and that I was subjected to, it made it very personal for me because there's this kind of rhetoric. We hear it in the news. We hear it in conversation with our neighbors and friends. We hear it in religious conversations. There's this kind of rhetoric or narrative around prison system and the criminal justice system that it's about punishment and then rehabilitation. And I learned the opposite. I learned that the truth, the kind of true measure of this beast is really it's about punishment and it's about warehousing, and that is it. And so when that kind of that truth became very real, very eminent to me, I decided, hey, I have such a bone with this that I'm gonna endeavor against it. And that's what I've done pretty much ever since then.
You've got a pretty in-depth collection of articles that touch on a lot of different topics that are all connected to the criminal justice system. And like my wife and I, you called them anti-rhetorics. Rhetoric meaning like, statements people throw around that sometimes get so used to being said that you don't even think about them when you say them. Drugs kill brain cells. One of the things that I and my partner have pushed back on is the idea of drugs in drug use, especially drugs like meth and cocaine and heroin and opioids, being on a opposite side of success from things like school and full-time jobs and being parents or siblings or friends. And you have challenged this head-on with one of your articles about education that described how you used meth, much like what my wife and I both used drugs to get through our college degrees, to fuel your learning potential. And you found this mix that worked for you, that instead of just falling prey to the rhetoric of when you use drugs, everything else is you're going to fail, channeled that energy and actually got your degree in large part because of successful use of meth.
So that kind of talk it's a sham. So it's kind of like saying, drug use begets failure. It's kind of like saying a lack of crime creates crime. It's oxymoronic where it stands, and it's both self-fulfilling and self-defeating. Mm-hmm. But here's the reality is that there's this kind of false dichotomy around drug use as being solely about the lack or absence of use is equated with success, and the consumption or use is equated with failure in varying degrees. And we know that that's not true. We know that with drug consumption and drug use, drug culture, like with any other sphere of human existence, there are degrees, there are gray areas. And I know a lot of people, while I personally no longer use, I've recovered or whatever language you want to use.
Just grew up, changed a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I made those choices for myself, but I actuated my own autonomy, my own self-discretion to make those choices. But as you said, through the height of my bachelor and graduate degree programs, when I was pursuing my master's degree, I'm currently pursuing my doctorate. But when I was pursuing my bachelor's and my master's degree at that time, I was primarily doing that while also litigating against the Department of Corrections, representing myself at the time. So I had a full-scale legal action going on. And I forgot to say that I was working on my habeas corpus at that time, which is how I got a sentence reduction. So I had two legal actions going on while pursuing my bachelor's and my MA. Looking back, I'm actually kind of in all of that. And the credible thing about it is the legal work that I did wasn't just passing muster. It was so good that it's now been cited by the ACLU in numerous amicus curiae briefs, which are friends of the court briefs. It's influenced legal scholarship, and it's considered a bright line rule inside of transgender prisoner healthcare. So I did a great job while pursuing my degrees, and it was I was using methamphetamines. Number one, I had more time on my hands than the average student because I was incarcerated. But the methamphetamines just expanded my bandwidth, so to speak. And we know that individuals, there are tons of functioning addicts, functioning consumers, functioning users, whether it be alcohol, whether it be whatever your preferred enjoyment is, So there is kind of this false dichotomy around the idea that indulgence is always equated with a failure, and that's not true. And I think I said in that article actually that it's kind of ironic because part of my path that led me to incarceration definitely revolved around drug use, but it was kind of an uncontrolled, unstructured, purposeless drug use. Whereas I think later on during my incarceration, I was using my drug use at that time to serve my own purpose. Like I had an agenda, I had a goal, and I had a future vision in sight. And so I just needed kind of a, pun intended, some fuel to get to get where I was trying to go. So
yeah, that's how I read it. I've used some of this language of like buffer zones or between spaces, between one part of your life, one chapter of your life, and whatever's next. And as we all grow up, exactly what you said, we realize, well, we've been told some awful stories about these substances, but then we start to replace them with other stories that are usually, what am I trying to feel, or what am I trying to turn on or accomplish by using this substance? And much like you're talking about, meth is a drug that plugs the holes of, this is awesome, I want to like go out and do stuff. And sometimes people can get there by themselves. I know people that are just like that. It must be really freaking nice. Whereas drugs like opioids plug these holes of like, oh, I feel like I just wrote a thesis already, I feel fulfilled. And as most of us that navigate this get to those points, we fill in the holes so we don't have to only use the substance that works so well for us. But this is the story you're not going to hear very often in the doctor's office or the 12-step meeting.
No. And I always tell people that for me, my process was actually very discoveratory. You know, like I did not know that I was going to end up pursuing post-secondary education while incarcerated. It was a total fluke. It was literally at that time I was caught up in my typical, I guess I was very much so caught up in addiction as what I was at that time. And it was not healthy. I did not have a controlled dynamic over my consumption. And I was in the earlier years of my incarceration. So I didn't really see when you hand a 19-year-old a 30-year sentence, which was, a, you know, 14-year sentence, that to them seems like the rest of their lives. Okay. Because I had a 30 do 14. And so that looks like to them for the rest of their lives, you know? And so I was very depressed and I didn't go into prison with a plan. Like I cannot tell you that lie. And anybody that does tell you that lie, like that they're, it's ridiculous. I went into prison not knowing what I was going to do. I really couldn't even see the end. It was unfathomable for me to envision the end of that time. So I ended up being caught up in the throes of my high and being like, and luckily, actually, before I ever even knew that there would be bachelor's, before I even got accepted into a master's program, I had already written in my own kind of musings a lot of the content that would be used as the premise for my research for my thesis, and then also for my doctorate, coincidentally. We can talk about that later. So it literally started off as a spark. I was like, I have all this energy. I'm doing all this stuff. Because, you know, at first it was outrage against the system for not validating me as a trans person and not enabling me to continue my transition, which I had started prior to incarceration. And I felt like they had put up these barriers that precluded my access to care that for me was critical in my assessment. And so I never had purpose before. Like I was never the type of person that was very goal oriented. I didn't have that kind of a je ne sais quoi about being goal oriented and about being like a go-getter or whatever. And for me, I think having that excess energy and having that hyper-focus, but also having the abundance of time and very little to do with it, that they all kind of factored together with the meth. And that was what, you know, kind of was a combustible factor that caused me to do the litigation. And I was like, hey, I'm kind of good at this. Maybe I could have a future. And I wrote hundreds of letters before I finally found financial sponsors that the college thing could even be a dream. And then I still spent months wrestling with myself, really questioning my self-worth, because the story that society had told me, the story that foster care had told me, and the story that I told myself was that this was all I was ever going to be, was, you know, a trans person who was a sex worker, was a convicted sex offender, drug addict, whatever. So in all honesty, meth was part of my cathartic process, but it was also part of my ameliorative process, like my healing or whatever. And then once I was able to take kind of control over my own narrative and begin to rewrite the path that I would walk in the future, that's when I was able to change my relationship with drugs and with a lot of other things and begin to kind of take back my power and stake it out the way that I saw fit.
Yeah, it'd be great if we could just set up prisons and whatever you want to call them, rehabs, but they would be more like places where you just go to get drugs that are, you know, legal, so you don't have illegal dealers, and include all the stuff you're talking about in there, an educational counselor, a therapist, a counselor that's not licensed as a therapist, a psychiatrist, a group meeting of people who still actively use drugs. And every time you go to get your meth, or in prison for that matter, you're not told, well, first thing you got to do is stop using this one thing that's working really well for you and unlocking parts of your brain that you feel like have been shut off. And instead of doing that, saying, what else you want? Right? Like, of course, if you want heroin right now, here's a hug to go with it. But what can we, or whatever drug, if you need it, power to you. But what else do you want to do? What can we do with that? It's almost like we're a how-to. We're certainly not a PSA that says you should start using meth because you'll get a degree. This is a PSA that says if you're using a substance, recognize what the substance is doing and what you might be able to do to put it to work, to use those feelings you're finding in your life.
And that's one of the more intricate components, but unsung components about what harm reduction is all about. We hear harm reduction philosophy and practices very much so popularized in terms that actually seem to be connected with or have a bare correlation with abstinence or prevention. But yeah. The reality is that for many people, they have no desire and they may never have any desire. And then other people have neurobiological factors that literally make the removal of substance consumerism unlikely or even unhealthy for them. So it's like you have to take people where they are and create space with them, not for them, with them, that allows them to endeavor forward with whatever advantages or handicaps they may come with. And for some people, like my story, like you just said, the PSA is not necessarily, hey, do meth and you'll get a master's degree. That's not the PSA at all. What the PSA about harm reduction, especially in terms of kind of the carceral environment and drug culture, is more of, if this is already going to occur, how can we make it a benefit rather than a handicap? So I'm actually slowly but surely beginning to see that narrative fashion. It's burgeoning, and I'm beginning to actually see it play out in real lived lives of other incarcerated people who I have known or who I now advocate on behalf of and work with. So it's very interesting to actually see that kind of a truth replicate itself.
Yeah, so we got this term harm reduction that's felt to me like it was going to show up at the front of our conversation like it just did, and that it'll probably cap our conversation. But I want to like paint a picture for people that are listening about why harm reduction should not only be a thing in public. I think most people are coming around to some version of that, you know, between seatbelts and helmets and all the stuff that you can use to say this is all it is. But when you think about prison, I think most people would just say, shut up. Like, there's nothing in their minds that they can make sense of needing a harm reduction approach or how it would work. What are the drugs that are in prison nowadays? When somebody says, I got some drugs, what do you see the most often?
So I have sources at more than a dozen prisons in the state of Georgia. I have literally hundreds of prisoners who I regularly advocate for and talk with, write letters, do all types of campaigns for. So I'm very plugged in. But, you know, there are kind of like in the country, how there are markets and there's an economy. In prison, there is an economy that is a microcosm of the larger economic and financial structures of our country and our world. And so like in a regular market, there is surplus and there's deficit and there's changing prices and there's changing inventory. So at any given time, depending on what institution you're at and what region that institution is in, because this state's correctional apparatus is broken up into regions, there can be different things. But for general, in that article, most people that I spoke to, they talk about strips. Strips is just a strip of piece of paper that is cut roughly about an inch and a half, maybe 2 inches. And it can be soaked with a myriad of chemicals like K2, insecticide is a popular one. All you have to do is Google that for some very interesting stories. There have been all different types of stuff. Of course, methamphetamines is very popular in the prison system, especially in the South. The good old staple of alcohol is a very popular substance down here.
It's harder to make than people think when you're in prison, though, unless you just want to get sick.
Well, are you talking about the alcohol specifically?
Yeah, the alcohol. Yeah, and I think you actually had a picture in the article with a caption that said, you got to make sure you do this the right way or you end up with something you really don't want to drink.
Yeah, you got to, there's a whole process to it. And I don't know the whole distillery process. I actually spoke to like 3 different guys to try to understand the distillation process. And apparently it's quite a bit of chemistry to it.
Yeah, yeah. But, and just, you get good at stuff. There's always an old head in prison that can do something you can't believe they can do.
It's the sheer amount of creative, electrical, all different types of intelligence that thrive in this place. There is so much untapped human resource and potentiality in prison institutions all across this country. It is absurd. Some of the most brilliant, most talented people I have met have criminal convictions. And I don't know what the corollary is there. I'm not sure if sociologists or psychologists have done any type of study, but I have met some phenomenal people.
I think it's that identity you're talking about. We tend to be these really clever fucks that at a young age already have something along the lines of what you mentioned, some strikes on our record in stories and identities that are being told to us and placed on us. And when we find an edge in the system, we can hustle somebody for some fake dope. We can steal somebody's purse. We know how to pick locks. We know how to hotwire cars. We know how to sell dope, sell sex. We're like, well, what else do I got going on for me? There's something to lean into. And I'm telling you, now that I'm teaching incarcerated students in bachelor's programs through CU Denver, through University of Colorado in Denver in prisons, it is bananas.
Thank you for doing, by the way. Thank you.
I'm selfish. Everything about it has been this strange trip down memory lane because I've been to prison, a prison very much like where I'm teaching. And these students are, I don't want to say they're the best students because that's not really fair. I've had really good students on the campus too. But per capita, these are the most engaged, stereotype breaking. We spent the first semester talking through the fact that the Civil War was about slavery and was more than just like on the verge, but like even the secession documents themselves outline the institution of white supremacy. The Confederate flag was designed to be. Some of these Southern students are freaking out, but they walk through conversations about gender, conversations about sexuality. In prisons are still to this day very homophobic spaces, transphobic spaces, and they like are now writing poetry about having experienced these things in classes, and they're going back on the yard and then having these conversations with other people in the prison. I don't know how else you instigate a change in the system like that unless you get the people that are there on board. So anyway, there's my
academics is radical transformation, man.
Yeah. We got off target. Let's get back to the drugs before we get too far out. And we'll make sure we end back on education and harm reduction specifically. You mentioned earlier, like the system, prison isn't what people really think. It seems more like just a machine that's grinding away. And the goal isn't really to rehabilitate so much as contain and keep people punching checks. And when I look at our drug war in the current system of drug regulation, it feels like over and over a very similar story. Nobody enjoys some people actually do, but it's not as good of a drug as marijuana is, but people use it because it's cheaper and it doesn't show up in drug tests. Fentanyl fucking sucks. I was addicted to heroin and Oxycontin for 6-7 years, and near the end I used fentanyl patches because they were I could find them sometimes when heroin was slim, but they wear off really quick. They kick in too hard. Instead of being able to get a nice buzz, you just crash out. You got to reuse all the time and you're risking overdose. Nobody would use it if they could get cheap, affordable heroin, and nobody would be using Raid is what you were talking about earlier. Yeah. Insecticides that are being sprayed on paper, but they can't be detected in a drug test and they're cheaper than K2. So absolutely, we're in this weird system now where strips are a thing. And as you said, when somebody says strips, you want to buy some strips, you probably don't even know what are in them. They're just something that someone came across somewhere that they soaked into paper and realized they can get high.
Yeah, on the substance. There's a cross variation of different types of strips. And a lot of times people are buying them just kind of under that umbrella phraseology, because it can be oven cleaner baked onto a piece of paper. So a lot of people don't oftentimes care what they're getting, but also in an environment of sheer deprivation and desperation, people don't care what the substance is so long as it helps to reshape the parameters of the reality. And when you're talking with people that have, and I think you can see it in my article, a few guys expressed the sentiment of, in other words, it was something along the lines of, we can't get out, so we might as well get fucked up. Okay. Can I curse?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think I already beat you to it.
So the whole, and I think they actually said it far more catchily than I, you know, it was more catchy than I just said it. That is a very real thing in here. And what you just said, you said something along the lines of prison is essentially this mechanism that just, you know, eats up people. And that's very true. And we see this kind of use of institutions and processes throughout human history to get rid of the undesirables, which have always been the poor and whatever other class of people at that time fall in disfavor with the establishment, whether that be Protestants during the Reformation, whether that been Jews during the Dysphoria or during Nazi Germany, women, etc. We've seen war be used as a tool to get rid of the disfavorable. We've seen slavery being used to get rid of the disfavorable and to possess them as equity. We've seen incarceration as a continuation of that corrupt, ill legacy of slavery. And it's just the most recent manifestation of a multi-tiered, multi-factored process, a state-sanctioned process that is meant to institute control, to criminalize because something is truly wrong or because the lawmakers say it's wrong, which is the difference between malum in se and malum prohibitum. But also it's to control economic portions and to cause disparity, class disparity. And it's for a slew of other factors. So we know that prison is actually very little about rehabilitation. And it's much, much more about, number one, it's a financial cycle. And then number two, it's warehousing. And number three, it's punitive. And that's just about all it is. And we see that because of the amount of federal and state dollars that go into the criminal justice system, that go into police budgets, and they go into prisons. Very little of those funds, hardly any significant portion, are going towards programs that have been shown. Like, there are programs that have been shown to have 10% or less recidivism rates. For example, in Georgia, in Washington, and California, the Braille programs, newspaper programs, and podcast programs all have 10 to 0% recidivism for successful completions. The ministry programs for prison fellowship out of Alabama, California, Washington, and Louisiana have 0% recidivism. Why are state federal dollars not being redirected towards this? Despite the fact that the Pell and Hope grants and scholarships have now been opened back up to state prisoners, we see the kind of creation of a post-secondary college infrastructure. It's being created very slowly, and it's being delayed and deferred by prison officials and state government officials for a reason, because despite the rhetoric, there is no actual spirit in our institutions about rehabilitation. We literally want to sit people somewhere and warehouse them.
And that's the public. I posted a picture of Colorado's death chamber because they pulled it out of the prison I teach at in 1987, and they moved it all of next door at the old women's facility that's now a museum, right? Wow. And I went and saw it a couple weeks ago and posted just a video of being in there and sort of talking about, like, I am totally blown away by spectacles of death. Not that death creeps me out so much as the romance that our culture just, like, drapes over it. In that video, compared to, like, what I normally post, had 10 times as many views and all sorts of awful comments about what's wrong with the tree. Everybody is a pussy now. They took it out of prison, right? Add the misogyny in with the insult. Yeah. That's what gets people's attention. When you say prison, they're like, that's where you should throw people and make it as bad as possible. So now we've got these stats that say, well, when you defer some of that money to education, you actually spend a lot less in the future. And this has got some people's ears, but it's coming at the cost of prison industries. And that, I think, is going to be the thing that, I hate saying this, because once you understand the system, you realize, like, oh, you'd have to do this for it to work, and I don't want to do that. I think we're going to have to make sure that whatever people are punching clocks is close to equal for what is lost on the prison industries, because the reason I'm teaching in college right now is because students on CU Denver's campus got pissed off that they found out all of our chairs, all of our desks, anything plastic, floor tile, concrete, wood had been purchased for prison industries for, like, the past 20 or 30 years. So they demanded we cut those off and that we fund college programs for 2-3 years. And so far we're in this sweet spot. What of all those contract monies that now are gone? that money was going somewhere and people were making some sort of profit or padding budgets on it. So unfortunately, I'm wondering if some of the stalling you're seeing, and I see it too, is people waiting for the first couple of years to go by so they can say, look, they tried it over there and look how bad things got. Let's not.
It's sad because it's really, it's just them. They've already, there's a disposition, in other words, a predisposition that is maintained by the kind of powers that be. And at this point, they've created a prophecy that they're going to see self-fulfilled through their own efforts and through a patent display of dishonesty and kind of prevarication around the facts and around the data. So what I think is so interesting, though, is number one is I would love to shake the hands of every single one of your students for doing their part in dismantling the economic prosperity of the prison industrial complex. But to me, you know, I think you just said something right there that I find so disheartening, but it also kind of brings out the warrior spirit in me. You were talking about how you posted about the death chamber chair that they moved into the museum that you went to see, and how people, and I always come across these comments because I post, I have prisoners from four different states that send me literally.
Yeah, you got some hilarious posts. You got some great posts, but you got some hilarious posts too.
Well, thank you so much. I try, but I get pictures from all these prisoners' videos and I try to share these things. And I always get these creeps, these weirdos like you did, that have these really negative, non-contributory kind of comments to throw in, like, well, that's what we should do with them, or they deserve worse, or they should this, or they should that. And I always like to remind these people, I like to challenge them of their own kind of value of existentialism, which is kind of like this, like, we as people and we as Americans, one of the, I guess, the hallmarks of our identity on both the national stage and the international stage, and as we as our people, is how we treat those who we would mete out punishment to. Mm-hmm. The reality is that you may not have done something this bad as this person, whether it's objectively or subjectively bad. You may not have done this and this person did. But if your measure of justice is best depicted through the harshest, most inhumane, most gross, most violent conditions that you can possibly construct, then your humanity is abysmal. Like, if that is what you want to see, if that is what you think is the ultimate conception of the justice system, these abysmal conditions, then you are just like a shitty person. And the reason why is because the prison system as it was created today, now here's the part of me as a theologian and a historian that's going to chime in. It was created actually by Quakers who were revamping a Puritan idea, because before, corporal punishment and death sentences were handed out for just about everything. You could lose a hand, an eye, your genitalia, anything for everything, you know?
And it was cheaper. It's cheaper to just kill them. Right.
Yes, there really wasn't a prison system beforehand. It was, prisons were really jails. They were short term and they were only for the very well born. Mm-hmm. Now, there were a few paupers prisons maintained by the churches, but that was usually for bills, for rents unpaid and stuff like that. Okay. Yeah. So the prison system was actually, even though it strayed from its original intention, it was actually designed to be rehabilitated. It was designed with the idea. And that's why I say, I call it Christian activism or Christian spirit is so compatible with prison reform and prison abolition, et cetera, criminal justice reform, because they're both about the spirit of redemption, about second chances and about restoration, about brighter futures, better hopes, et cetera. And prisons were built, they were meant to be redemptive environments where people could consider their wrongs. They could learn skills or assets, make connections, get out, restart their life, having paid their debt. It's no longer about that. We've strayed so far from what the spirit of prisons were about, okay? They were meant to be corrective. And even though we use the word corrections, we see that word corrections attached to almost every state penal agency. The issue is that there's not any corrections being done. We're not curating these environments that are actually about redeeming people and enabling meaningful reentry that actually divests people of criminogenic factors while equipping them with potential and shaping a future and a life for them. And part of that is because we've moved away from narratives and stories and ideals about community and got very tied up into the individualistic philosophy of today. When we start looking at corrections and criminal justice and rehabilitation in terms of being beyond just individual victim perpetrator narratives, but actually being about collective community identities and national identities, then we might actually begin to see real restorative justice when it's community centered.
Yeah, new co-host of the podcast, See Dreams, y'all. You're clearly gonna have to come back, because I don't think we're opening new doors. We're not only not gonna get through what we were gonna today, but man, we got a lot to talk about.
Oh my God, I would love to. Anytime you want me back, I'll come back.
So let's circle around to our drugs. We were talking about drugs in prison, and we've now made this sort of like a nice bow on the top with identity and alternatives to just, you know, doing dope all day long if it was something you could afford. What have you seen change since COVID hit?
In the prison system specifically?
Yeah, right. With drugs coming in, with what drugs are there, with how drugs get in, with how many
people. When I tell you, I got literally several dozen letters and JK emails and phone calls from family members and incarcerated people. COVID changed not only the economy, but it's changed kind of the whole, I want to say sociology, that may be a little far-reaching, but the whole sociology of the prison system. COVID brought understaffing. And the thing about it is, almost everything that I'm going to say, I know for a fact happened in Georgia, but I don't want to hyper-localize this because I have spoken to prisoners across this country and I've paid attention to publishing from state legislators and stuff like that. The pandemic created a second unsung epidemic inside of the correctional enterprises of this country, and it was the understaffing crisis. And with understaffing, there came skyrocketing rates of sexual assault, rape, organized gang violence, kind of organized predatory systems actually have been observed by a few clinical behaviorists who have been inside prisons studying this. Murder and suicide rates went off the chart in Georgia, so bad, so much so that it sparked a U.S. Department of Justice investigation, the second such investigation being done into Georgia. The first one was launched in 2014 because of the Ashley Diamond lawsuit and the Christina Lynch lawsuit, two transgender women who were incarcerated and were being sexually assaulted. So that was the first Department of Justice investigation. But now, because of the COVID pandemic, the understaffing, the rates of murder, sexual assault, suicide, it's now actually being investigated again. There have been so many lawsuits. It is ridiculous. Like, a law school could literally do a sound curricula just based off of the issues that have been presented in the myriad of lawsuits revolving around conditions of confinement, medical care, failure to protect, assault, a slew of issues. So there has been a change in the power structure. You know, there used to be this movie, I think it was called Life.
Martin Lawrence,
you know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, Martin Lawrence Life. And Eddie Murphy is in it too, I think.
Yeah, weren't they? They were incarcerated, right? This is the right movie, right?
Yep.
Okay, and so do you remember that kind of depiction of like the orderly, the trustee who had the shotgun, who was policing the rest of the prisoners?
Yep.
Okay, well, that's very much, it hasn't gone that far, but prisoners are running the institution. They're running it almost in the capacity of being staff. So you might have three officers, all of whom are female, with 1,500 male prisoners, and they have to try to run this institution to the best of their ability. Of course, during the height of the pandemic, there were institutional lockdowns, so there wasn't as much going on, there wasn't as much movement, and it was easier to control. But also, this was because prisoners were encapsulated and quarantined to their living units. There was kind of these unsupervised and unrestrained outbursts of violence, too. Yeah. So it's had so many different contributing factors that I think that interested sociologists and journalists and lawmakers could really study these issues for years in order to pursue new policies.
Yeah, it seems like when the staffing crisis showed up, both on the streets with police officers and with COs in prison, it was unfortunately the majority of what we would think of as the good or the better or the dedicated folks that were like, it's time to retire, I don't need this shit no more, it's dangerous. And it was this perfect storm, not only of, well, then I guess everybody's got to be locked down. There was nobody to watch. You describe in the article how you used to have to fly drones over and try to drop drugs on the yard and let somebody know when to keep an eye out. There's people just now walking up to fences and just chucking them over because they don't have the COs to watch. And the programs are gone. So when you would be struggling, if you're somebody that was addicted to heroin, you've decided to stop and you've been, quote, clean and sober for 3 years, you're now locked in a cell. Your church is gone. Your college is gone. Your visitation's gone. And you're just in the cell all day. It's this perfect storm of drugs are suddenly more abundant and there is jack shit to do. We're miserable and there's more danger. All of that adds up to this perfect storm that we're also seeing out in the world with the overdose crisis.
They literally, if they wanted to escape, they could. They literally were jumping from all the reports I received. They were literally going up to the security perimeter fences of the prison, jumping over, grabbing the contraband and coming right back in. Like, they weren't interested in escaping because this environment had been cultivated for them. Where
so you mean, let's make sure people understand what you're saying. You're saying on the double fences, most facilities have two fences with nothing in between them but rolls of razor wire to eat your ass up. You're saying they chuck it over and it get caught in between?
Yeah, and they would just get it and come back in because this environment had been created where they were essentially in control. They were dominant. They had their basic needs met. They were able to get all of their contraband needs satisfied. So what's the point of going out? We don't need to go out. That's the whole mindset, you know? Yeah. And the reality is, like you just said, is that there is no programming. And in many states, Colorado is one of the few ones, there really isn't any college programming. So when we talk about programming, they're talking about classes like here in Georgia, they have several classes like motivation for change and thinking for a change and matrix and SOPP. These classes are all like behavior modification classes, like anger management classes, sex offender programming classes, stuff like that. So they get dollars, state and federal dollars for these. And I know a lot about the New York system and the Maryland system and the Florida and Georgia systems. They get a lot of dollars for these. But actually what I've, and I'm investigating this currently, I've been getting reports out of three different states from literally dozens of prisoners that since the pandemic, the officials at various institutions have been forging paperwork saying that they still have the prisoners, the inmates, the incarcerated people. I know that that phrase right now is very inflammatory. People get mad when you use the word prisoner right now.
It is what it is. Yeah. You're in prison. I try not to use it too, but everything.
I try not to, but it's so.
Person language, I gotcha.
So facile. It's so
we
easy.
Count though. We've both been there, so I can say junkie.
I'm just.
I am a junkie.
But I hate that phrase, justice impacted too. Like,
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, like let's soften it a little more. Like it isn't. You were run over by a steamroller. You weren't impacted.
I'd rather
you were plowed down.
Justice raped, maybe justice savage.
And then you get the pushback from the other side, though, because you can't use that term in a way that that takes away from the power of it.
That's a whole nother topic we need to do one day about the hypersensitivity, but.
Yeah, no shit. Like, how do we find that right? This is the reason I'm so worried the pendulum's going to come crashing back and we're going to see, say, Trump Jr. come into office for 8 years, followed by his sister. Because, some of these liberals have gotten so damn woke that we're like, stop saying that the reason your coffee is cold is systemic racism. You're pissing people off. That's not why it's cold. But it must feel good to be woke.
I think that woke is incredibly dangerous. And a few of my friends who are more liberal than I am, they accuse me of being conservative, which I don't think I'm conservative. I think I'm a moderate. I think, you know, I like good policies and I like good sense. And it's difficult to talk about issues, whether it be social justice issues, criminal justice issues, issues of race, education, gender, sexuality. It's difficult to talk about anything because, unfortunately, people always attach this kind of, I hate to say it, but this butt soreness to everything. You know, it's just like you literally risk. And I know this is just part of living in the world, but I should not risk every time that I state something, especially when I can state with facts. Like the moment I can cite some statistics or studies, your ability to take umbrage, to be offended, should just go out the window. We live in this world where everybody wants to have an opinion so much, which is perfectly fine. I support the First Amendment, have your opinion. But your opinion does not give you exclusivity to the point that you can just be offended every time that you hear or see something that you disagree with. And while all people to an extent get offended, they have, you know, contentions with things that are said or done, I feel like we have, I was just actually listening to, I don't know if you listen to New Discourses. I love New Discourses, James Lindsay, but I was actually just listening to his podcast about, what is it called? Enforced tolerance or something like that, repressed tolerance or whatever. But he was talking pretty much like tolerance is almost violence because we're forced to be tolerant of everything to the point that like everybody's so super sensitive. And I got into an argument with somebody recently about the word prisoner to cycle that, you know, circle that back and make it make sense. I got into an argument with somebody about the word prisoner. And then I guess they didn't realize that I had been incarcerated. I had been justice impacted. So I brought that up. And that
it sounds funnier every time you say it. I don't know if I've heard that term used, justice impacted.
And when I told her that, it just fanned the flames of her righteous umbrage. Like, she's like, and you should know better. You've been there. Da, 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 da. And I was like, well, ma'am, have you been incarcerated? No, but my sister was. And I was like, you don't get out of here.
Well, in the prisons, this one's especially with prisoner and resident and inmate. These are terms that as we update them out in the world, don't forget that the administration of the DOCs are also figuring out clever ways to say, well, we call them residents now. We've done our part. I think that's what this whole thing is about. When you get woke and pissed off and they're like, you don't get to say that. That's racist. You feel like you just did something. You don't have to read a book. You don't have to double check. You don't have to have a dialogue. You just tell that motherfucker they were a racist and move on with your day and you get a gold star. We're never going to make real progress if we just keep staying with the easy layups that they're not even going in the rim, but we're celebrating on the way back down the court.
Yeah, people are out there throwing out racist and like words bigot and homophobic and transphobic like they earned them Boy Scout badges. So,
right. I made my mom mad. Doesn't that get me something?
Yeah.
All right, drugs.
Yes, sorry.
No, it's all right. I just glanced down. I was like, oh, see, this is what I told you would happen. I'm like, whenever I talk to somebody that I have a lot in common with, we're like, oh, let's talk about everything. And that's cool. So
I've had a wonderful time. I've enjoyed myself.
Good. Me too so far. So people are looking around during COVID and clearly they're noticing more people getting fucked up, more people miserable. And for those that don't know, most people probably know drugs in prison are expensive, but when you say a joint is $20 to $30 or $40, you're not talking about a joint. You're talking about a joint that is laughable. It's so small and it's probably half tobacco or dirt on the that they found on the ground or who knows what. And it's expensive every time you're using any drug. So now these folks are seeing everyone else get fucked up and they realize, oh, well, there's these new strips going around. So maybe they decide to buy some strips. How does one even use a strip?
Well, to answer the first part, that's how strips became popular because they filled an economic deficit. People couldn't afford their regular their regular preferred habits, their preferences for marijuana or methamphetamines the same way. And the high from strips is both fast and quite potent. So to the second part of the question is, so the strips are these little bits of paper. Like typically the way that it was being done at first is like somebody would take a whole piece of paper and I like spray it in whatever substance they wanted to use. And then they would break it up into little pieces of paper and they would roll it up like a cigarette or like a joint and just smoke it. It's very quick. And I had tried one several years ago and let me tell you, it is powerful. It's like a train, wham, 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 wham. But you know, when it came in and it was no longer K2 and it was because it was a little bit of Suboxone for a while too, but when it stopped being K2 and Suboxone and it started coming out that it was to further subsidize the cost, people were using Raid at that point. That's when, you know, I'm going to pass on that. Yeah, I'm going to pass on that. Yeah. And that's actually when we began to see the most frightening. You know, I've gotten so many reports from family members of incarcerated people and from incarcerated people, which this is after my time, so I can't speak for this part, but this is literally the symptoms that you saw from people smoking the strips after that kind of transitional period in late 2020 are the same symptoms you would see when somebody would spray a roach with Raid, like the kind of the daze, the legs failing, seizures, that type of stuff. And what's really funny is I feel like the South catches a lot of trends late because when you go and you Google the smoking of insecticides, you see the story start catching on in the Midwest in 2017 and 2018. And then you see it begin to pop up in Florida 2019. And then you slowly begin to see it. And I think I'm one of the few people that's written about it in Georgia. And I'm the only person that I know that has written about it in terms of the carceral setting. Mm-hmm. So,
I fancy, I love drugs. I do lots of drugs still to this day and got a long history with them. And this is one that I was like, wait, how have I not heard of this exactly? I know it makes me wonder if some of the old rumors we used to get in the 90s about when they make meth, they make it out of bug killer and drain cleaner. If there was some sort of mistake, like mixing of metaphors that the idiots that were lying to us about drugs didn't realize, because it's interesting that pyrethenes, I think is what the chemical is called, that they're the only way we know how to kill bugs. So once again, we're at a weird cultural spot where we can't get rid of all bug spray. I mean, like, there's people that would die if they're bit by certain bugs. You got to have an ability to kill bugs, and that's what's in all of these chemicals that are sold as bug killers. And you can't imagine a prison that doesn't have any insecticides anywhere, because it's a prison. You got to be able to definitely kill bugs in compacted areas.
Well, remember, I told you, I even received a couple reports about people using paint-based, like oil paint-based, and I got reports about people using oven cleaner. They were coating it on and crystallizing it. The thing about it is, when it comes to anything, any need or desire, but especially in terms of substance, people are going to, they're going to employ ingenuity, you know? Yeah. And when it comes to what I would term, I would tenuously term kind of a questionable consumption, I think that if we start questioning the group of one people for their choice of consumption, we have to begin to question everything else. Because I mean, like, you still have people, and I remember when I was in high school, this was popular. I used to do it. I used to go into CVS and buy the cans that you were spray to get the dust out of your keyboard. Yep. And we used to puff them. So, you know, like, that's questionable consumption. But in reality, most substances, if we're being honest, is questionable consumption. I have a dear friend of mine who is a avid fentanyl, like, enthusiast. She will fight you about it. And she's just all for the, you know, the careful, the careful use of it. Like, she's like, you know, use your good sense or whatever. And she knows all the facts. Like, you can't talk to this woman about it because she's going to wrestle you down.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, that's questionable consumption because of the inherent risk. But then when we talk about inherent risk, then we see that the kind of labeling questionable consumption begins to expand to almost every substance. That is ultimately why I always circle back to harm reduction, because even in terms of, like, and I know this is distorting it to some degree, but even in terms of, like, the mechanics of driving and the inherent risk of wrecks, like, seatbelt buckles is harm reduction. Some things people have to do and some things people want to do. And no matter how you feel about it, they're going to do these things because they either have to or they want to, whichever the choice is. And the only thing that we can do is provide, I guess, kind of, what are those rails? I had it in my
guardrails.
Bowling.
Bumpers. Yeah, the bumpers in bowling. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the bumper rail.
Yeah.
The
life. Cheater.
But cheaters. I know.
Yeah, well, we've arrived, though. Harm reduction, right? Which is what our goal was. So you just, like, swished one from half court. To start this part of where I think it's great to wrap this up, let's make sure we touch on injection in prison. There's a lot of people that actually still manage to inject drugs in prison. How in the world does one get a syringe in prison?
So, as I talked about in my article, you know, there is, and as I said earlier today, there is a market in prison. There's an entire economy, and goods that are very desirable for various reasons, they have different rates. In prison, of course, almost all things come in through the people that are employed here. That's the reality of it, you know, because it's a controlled environment. And a lot of the times prisoners we've seen it over and over again. You can get on TikTok and you can see videos of people cooking their food on coffee cans and stuff. It's really incredible.
It is.
What conditions of deprivation will, what levels of genius people in conditions of deprivation can rise to. So, you know, other ways that these syringes are garnered, of course, through medical. They are given out at the diabetic pill calls, so we're able to get them and you can pass them around, et cetera. And the biggest issues with the syringes that I saw, I talked to probably 24 different prisoners, and the biggest issue that I saw repeatedly was that it was so hard to keep a constant clean supply of syringes. You could get them in, you could get them through an officer who you were friendly with, or if you had a diabetic buddy, you know, and of course there were different prices for new and used syringes. So the biggest issue I was able to note was the amount of use was disproportionately high compared to the amount of supply for syringes, so much so that there is like a blockbuster system of syringe renting.
Oof. There's the scariest part of this whole thing is like, yeah, we're talking about sharing needles and passing them around. Anybody that's never used injection drugs for any amount of time, needles also get really dull really fast. It's weird that your skin does that to them because they're razor sharp and they go right in at first, but they turn into like, you got to just about shank them in. So it sounds like there's people that are sharpening them on rough concrete.
That's a trade. That's a trade in prison. There's needle sharpeners. It's an entire trade. Usually there's the same people that specialize in sharpening knives and other tools. It's an entire trade in here, like a blacksmith. But as you saw in my article, there was one guy that said that his good buddy, he said he had a syringe that looked like it came out of the 60s. I spoke with another person who was saying, and of course everybody in my article, they all have nicknames, they're all anonymous in order to protect their identity. And so one person that I talked to was telling me how, you know, you can only sharpen them for so long. And then a lot of people reported the same or similar techniques for cleaning the syringes and for trying to maintain them. But what is so crazy is that the amount of people who said that it didn't even matter. They were willing to take the kind of self-injury that comes with continued use of a dull needle. And yeah. So that to me was particularly frightening.
Yeah. We've done this great job of touching on probably half of the terrifying things in your article. People are taking strips of drugs because they're cheaper, they can't be tested, and fuck it, we're locked down anyway, that are sometimes raid. They don't know how strong they are. People nowadays, as in everywhere else, fentanyl is really easy to get in some different ways. The administration's trying to restrict that by like basically photocopying everybody's mail and never delivering it, but there's still a lot of drug issues going on. People are smoking strips. People are bugging out. That's funny. I don't think you called it that, but they're using too much and yeah, having these terrible reactions that are being called overdoses. And some of them are injecting these drugs with needles that appear to have been in the prison for 20, 30 years. They're resharpening them. The seals go bad. There's old dry blood in them. They're getting diseases and they don't give a shit to some. They're in a bad spot. They're going to use it anyway.
And don't forget that one of the major ways that new needles make it into circulation is through the biohazard bins from blood work and tetanus shots, flu shots, and other intravenous injections and stuff like that are done in the medical unit. They're then dispersed and sold at retail prices. So the exponential risk for contamination and for infection, the transmissibility of disease, actually continues to grow the more we layer on these facts. Like it's actually a very frightening picture. And there's one person who I talked to in the article who was an advocate for tattoo harm reduction practices in the prison system back in the 90s. And they were talking about how they tried to use those same approaches to kind of cross-platform it with the modern issue around syringes in the prison system. And even though there have been formal pushes, organized, well thought out formal pushes for harm reduction practices to be implemented in the prison system, administration officials and state agency officials have pretty much just acted with utter deliberate disregard. And the perceived answer has kind of been like, well, fuck you, you get whatever you get, you know?
Yeah, I told my class about this specific story that it was so well put together. And I have a lot of tattooed folks that are into drawing and creating tattoos and we're tattoo artists in the world. And I explained, okay, in prison, it's illegal to get tattoos. People do it anyway. It's dangerous. Equipment can't even be cleaned because it's like made in ways that it's really hard to get apart. And these tattoos often look like shit and people get major tickets for them because the state doesn't have photographs. They photograph you when you come in. If something changes and you're caught, you get a ticket for that. So these people say, let's open a harm reduction program. Let's be transparent. They deliver this proposal to the warden and say, we're tattoo artists. We want to set it up in a safe part of the prison with supervision, with photography equipment so you can immediately take a picture. We'll take the profits and we'll fund these better programs. And they're targeted. They not only were disregarded, as you said, by the administration, but immediately split up. They're sent to different prisons. Their cells are shaken down. This is what you get for your trouble. If you exactly. realize there's something in prison that's going to happen no matter what, and it's endangering lives, and we've got a choice to make, let people die because we don't care about those folks, or update the system, you're prone to get targeted for even mentioning that. So maybe this is a terrible question for you, but do you have thoughts on how to work around that? This might be a really good question for you, actually, for working around that stigma targeting that's liable to come when you're the person that speaks up or tries to organize some sort of solution.
Let me preface with this. The reaction by prison officials to the organizers of the prison tattoo parlor proposition is expected, and it's consistent with their reaction all the time. It's
My students weren't surprised at all. They were like, of course that's what happened to them.
It's an echo of any time there is especially an organized push for some type of reformation or program that is ultimately to the better and the rehabilitation, the betterment and rehabilitation of incarcerated people, especially if it's proposed by incarcerated people, there is always going to be this kind of utter response of this kind of utter decimation as response by prison officials. And so that's the first thing that we have to discuss is if you're going to be, whether individually or collectively, a voice for some type of reformation or betterment or rehabilitation, some type of programming, or whether just be a voice of advocacy and protest regarding prison conditions or any issue really at all, okay? Whenever you're finding yourself speaking truth to carceral or policing powers, you need to expect. You actually should be utterly shocked and incredibly suspicious if there are not, you know, retaliatory tactics employed.
I think they're probably coming.
Yeah, absolutely. if not overtly, then covertly. But one of the major things that I would say is necessary is compelled transparency. And I'm very fond of that phrase right there. You'll hear me, and a lot of the times when I write or if I talk, I use some variation of that you know, compulsory transparency or compelled transparency. And that takes more than just the people in the midst of a fight. In order to have compelled transparency, that means, you know, if these corrections officials don't want to allow you to implement this harm reduction practice or this reformatory practice or this rehabilitative program or whatever, then that is when you have to make the public aware of what's going on, understand the implications, understand the benefits, understanding the minimization of costs, understanding the reason for the pushback, etc. You also have to get other forms of government officials from other agencies or other divisions involved in the conversation. For example, don't you think that state lawmakers would want to know that there was this proposal that was put together by prisoners, which is number one, is indicative of accountability, is indicative of an effort to reform and rehabilitate yourself because there's no program or staffing that is doing it. It's indicative of a desire to contribute to a collective community-based identity. It's indicative of readiness or preparedness to return to society and contribute in a meaningful, constructive building way. So it's like, when we look at these types of proposals, we need to look at the kind of underlying motive and the characteristics that are involved with it, because I think lawmakers would be very interested in knowing that prisoners put this together and were interested in doing this thing for the better of the prison environment and the better of the people there, but prison officials had a less than lackluster, you know, something worse than a lackluster response to it. So I think that's one way to compel transparency. I think communicating through whatever channels are possible with other incarcerated people in your region or in your state to let them know that you guys pushed for this here. Can they try to emulate that push in the same or similar fashion where they are? Because systematizing and universalizing any type of effort for reform or rehabilitation improvement is very important. We have to show that it's not just a single pocket or a single space of
special privileges.
And it's important to also show that it's not just localized, that this need and this desire to push for it exists across the board. It's the same thing. Like if we talk about, let's talk about as a parallel, kind of like insurgents against a government power. If the government knows that there's only this one pocket of insurgents, then it's just going to wipe them out by whatever force. But if they know there are multiple pockets, they have to be more calculating and sometimes even more, give more concessions in order to reach an amicable resolution. Well, that kind of military / governmental tactics issue, it translates well into criminal and social justice reform efforts. You know, we need to show that there are pockets of our calls and that there are pockets of effort. So all of these things, I could kind of drone on about this a little bit more, but I don't want to go too far on a tangent. But all of these things can be employed and should be employed in concert to kind of compel transparency, because when people feel denuded, and when agencies feel shorn bare, that is when we actually begin to see the changes that we need. And any failings by the system, whether it be the prison system, the court system, the policing authority, the government, any failing by the established system is ultimately a failure of society. And so it's important that we organize in an effort with it kind of being at the forefront that what we're doing is ultimately community-based, and it's meant to improve the culture, improve the society, and to redeem people, which are the building blocks of the culture and the society.
Beautiful encapsulation of what we're trying to do here. I got a student that's really on the verge of putting together a project about what he's calling resexualization. We have like this illusion. Well, sex is against the rules in prison, right? So we have this what kind of humans expect other humans to really not have any sort of sexual identity for years at a time and then to be normal and adapted when they get out? That's one of those things.
It's criminalized. Sexuality in prison is criminalized. You can face charges because your ability to consent, which is another indicator of how prisoners are stripped of their humanity, is because your consent, your ability to consent, is stripped away. You're no longer able to legally consent to sexual interactions.
Yeah, and on top of that, on the heels of it are all the same things we've talked about now with tattooing and with drug use. Safe sex in prison is against the rules. You can't buy condoms. And if you get caught with a condom, you are going to get a ticket for having contraband in the facility. And again, all the clever things people do to try to navigate that in between space of both being restricted from loving somebody else physically for X amount of years, often that you end up locked up with if you're, I guess you could call it lucky. And then also to mitigate any dangers that come with being a human being and being sexual.
And actually kind of the asexualization or kind of a enforced desexualization of prisoners, which is also one of the components of the kind of a stripped down humanity of prisoners. It actually poses issues about resocialization because you've removed intrinsic and critical parts of human nature. Mm-hmm. Sexualization is related to romantics. It's related to compassion. It's related to intimacy. It's related to the ability to plan long term and build with a person. And so when you look at these kind of in the more macrocosmic situation, you see that it's actually derailing people and stripping them of essential characteristics and attributes that they need for successful societal reintegration and to actually thrive when they rejoin the community. So it's actually really crazy because a lot of the things that we do the name of corrections or in criminal justice actually end up further propagating, I guess, kind of a...
You don't say.
Failure stories, you know?
You don't say. Are you sure about that? Yeah, it's wild to live in a country that incarcerates a fifth of the people that are incarcerated and has a recidivism rate that if you just go out 5 years, I think 10 years, it's 85% of people are rearrested for new charges. So a lot of times we throw around like this 50% number. It's only 50% if you're counting within a year, which is pretty fast. It takes about a year to figure out what the fuck's going on when you get out of prison.
Well, the crazy thing about it is actually most of that recidivism rate is actually due to technical violations, which is because parole and probation and the sex offender registry are actually debt traps. They're vicious debt traps that make you choose between being housed or being impoverished. And if you're not able to pay costs related to like urinalysis, polygraphs, ankle monitors, sex offender therapy, anger management, whatever, then you are compelled back into prison. So you're constantly juggling these three balls of poverty, homelessness, or reincarceration. So that's actually accounts for a large portion. I don't know the exact number, but the large portion of the recidivism rate. And as you said, you know, we're, I think, 4%, 5% of the world population or something like that, but we're 25% of the incarcerated population in the world. So
something fishy is going on over here, but it's that big business. It's even what you just said, this is the transition that as we move away from, if we even downgrade the mass incarceration, it looks like the only way that's happened and will continue to happen is by basically shuffling those same bodies out to other clock punchers, like private prison ankle monitor companies, private parole companies, rehab, the rehab industrial complex. And hopefully conversations like this and a lot of the work that's going on right now prevents that from just being another era that we'll look back on ashamed of in 100 years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Final thoughts? Anything we missed? Of course, there's stuff we missed.
We did miss some stuff, but you know, you invited me back and I would love to. I'm looking forward to that. But I think that we had overarchingly, I think we had a great conversation. I feel like we had a good variety. We came at the topic from multiple angles and thoroughly, I enjoyed myself. I'm super, super grateful to have been here with you today, Ben, and really enjoyed myself. So
I appreciate it. These are always my most enjoyable talks too. So this was fun. If people want to reach out to you, is Twitter the best place?
Yes, I love Twitter. I'm addicted to it. You can reach out to me on Twitter. Well, I have been thinking about leaving, but I don't think I'm going to leave because
I don't think anybody's going to leave.
It's kind of like...
Well, I read a tweet you wrote about this a couple of days ago, so I interrupted you while you were saying it. You did have a legitimate argument about possibly sticking it out to make sure it doesn't get too cesspool, because if we all leave, it turns into Truth Social.
Absolutely. I feel like I'm going to get lambasted by somebody for what I'm about to say. This is totally a joke, so don't get mad. I'm like one of those wives that she knows she should leave her husband, but she won't. That's how I am with Twitter.
I don't think you said anything bad yet. You could go a couple more sentences and get in trouble if you wanted, but
no,
I can relate to that. I've been in those relationships.
In the art of cutting short.
Yeah, nice. I'll take it. Well, this has been a blast. I appreciate it, and I'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
Bye, Ben. Thank you.
That was C Dreams. And again, her work and contact info is linked in the episode description. I'm sure she'll be back sometime in the future, so feel free to send me any topics or questions you might want to hear us talk about. Until then, love yourselves and the addicted people in your life. I'm Ben Boyce.